The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky will today meet with US Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio at the Munich Security Conference to talk about a potential peace deal with Russia. Now, overnight, Russia struck the former Chernobyl nuclear power plant, damaging a structure which prevents radiation from leaking from the site. The International Atomic Energy Agency says radiation levels remain normal as of now. Russia will not be officially attending the conference in Munich, but Donald Trump suggested there would be three-way discussions between the U.S., Russia and Ukraine.
They're having a meeting in Munich. Russia is going to be there with our people. Ukraine is also invited, by the way. Not sure exactly who's going to be there from any country, but high-level people from Russia, from Ukraine, and from the United States.
Now, he provided no further information on the suggestion, but Ukraine has said three-way discussions will not be happening today, and the BBC is reporting that it's unlikely that any Russians would be given visas to visit Munich. So to look at what actually will be happening, we are joined by Donnacha Bachoin, Professor of Politics at the School of Law and Government at DCU. Donnacha, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
So what will happen? We know who's going to be there, but who will actually meet?
Well, we know that Volodymyr Zelensky will meet Vice President Vance, and that in itself is a step forward, believe it or not, because J.D. Vance was at the Munich Security Conference last year, as was President Zelensky, and Senator Vance, as he was then, refused to meet Volodymyr Zelensky. He said around the same time that he had no interest really in what happened in Ukraine either way. So he's there at Trump's behest, but as we know, Trump has been reaching out to Vladimir Putin and has already conceded a lot on Ukraine's behalf before even any formal negotiations have begun. So I suspect that Vance and Special Envoy Kellogg are there to communicate what they have in mind, the broad contours of what they have in mind, and test the reaction. It's kind of Trump's strategy in a way to throw out sometimes outlandish ideas, you know, annexing Greenland, the Gaza Riviera, and see what people say in response, and then perhaps modify slightly their, or indeed fundamentally, their proposals. I mean, you have to remember that during Trump's first presidency, there was that grand idea of building that wall at Mexico's expense. It never happened. So we always have to be careful when trying to gauge Trump's ideas.
But the notion is that Donald Trump is better prepared this time than he was the last time. Any of the naysayers that might have been around him in his cabinet are not likely to be included. They're all yay-sayers that he's picked for key positions. So whatever he says will go.
That's true. And that's disconcerting in a way as the U.S. moves closer and closer to an oligarchy, if not a monarchy. So, yes, there are very few checks and balances right now. Congress, the Senate, the Supreme Court all have Republican majorities. But at the same time, you know, Trump is not the master of all he surveys. I mean, indeed, you might say his election in many respects was a symptom of the U.S.'s declining role in the world. And it's kind of almost King Canute trying to push back that tide. But he's going about it, of course, in a very antagonistic way, and I would say a counterproductive way, by alienating the U.S. allies. I mean, the U.S. has enough adversaries in the world, but as you know, in the last month, he has, you know, taken on Canada, trying to say it might be the 51st state of America. He says he wants Panama back. He's, you know, started a fight with Denmark over Greenland. He's, of course, advocating ethnic cleansing in Gaza. And he's essentially also hinting that the security guarantee to Europe might be withdrawn. So there's a lot of things out there, but whether he has the power to implement them all, I very much doubt. And similarly with this reaching out to Putin, the fact that Putin and Trump agree on something doesn't mean that it's going to actually work out on the ground. You must remember that when the war began, or this phase of the war, the full-scale invasion in February 2022, Ukraine was already on its own. It didn't receive any troops. The embassies were vacated, and yet they pushed the Russians back. So just because you know, the Americans think there's a certain fate or destiny for Ukraine doesn't necessarily mean that's the way it's going to pan out.
Now, the question of American withdrawing its security support for Europe and, you know, those NATO countries and other non-NATO countries having to rely on their own defence rather than having the security blanket, if you like, of a friendly United States over it. I mean, there will be a response from the other NATO countries, I presume. There will be a beefing up of defence expenditure. That's already happening. I think it was 12% is going to be the additional expenditure. It's going to be massive. But can Europe survive without that security guarantee from the United States?
Not if all other things stay the same. I mean, if the Americans withdraw that security guarantee and Europe does nothing, Europe is in jeopardy. There's no question there. The Ukrainians, in that sense, have defended Europe because Russia is very much weakened now. So even if there was a freezing of the conflict overnight, which is, I don't think is going to necessarily happen, it would be a while before Russia would be able to regroup and target any other country, be it, you know, Finland or Estonia or Moldova or Poland or whatnot, or even regroup and try and take other parts of Ukraine as it did after 2014. So in that respect, Europe is perhaps safe for now. But the level of investment in defence and security, and this touches on the discussion you already had earlier this morning with Declan Powell, is very low. Ireland is the outlier in being the lowest of all, of course. But other countries spend far below what they're necessary. Now, there was, of course, an optimism there when the Soviet Union collapsed that there would be a peace dividend and that, you know, money that had been directed to fend off, you know, the Soviet Union and protect the Iron Curtain from extending, that could be rediverted into health and education and the kinds of things that we all want to spend money on. But the Russian threat remains there. And the Russian threat is not based on its economy. I stress often that the Russian economy is about the size of Italy's. It's smaller than that of Texas. But they do devote a huge percentage of their economy to their military industrial complex. And that's why they are so dangerous. And of course, as a dictatorship, they have very few checks and balances to stop Vladimir Putin using it. And also, of course, their friends, their allies, countries like North Korea, are similar in that respect. North Korea cannot feed its people, but it can supply Russia with more ammunition than the European Union has been able to provide Ukraine. So this is where the jeopardy lies. And unless Europe recognizes the challenge, and you can see the first signs that during these discussions that Europe is finally, I think, recognizing that right now, and it's a very hard thing to say, that the US is not necessarily an ally. It's treating Europe right now as an adversary, and even the discussion of punitive tariffs, unwarranted as they are, is symptomatic of that.
Now, when you say that the United States has been looking to punish its allies, its friends, rather than having a go at its enemies, do you understand where Trump is coming from? I mean, are these the oligarchs beside him who are calling the shots? Are these the architects of Project 2025 who are calling the shots? Or is he simply so fixated on money that he actually has no clue really about geopolitics?
It's very hard to get a reading of Trump. Certainly, he's illiterate in many things, not least in language, but I mean, economics, geopolitics. He has a very simple way of looking at the world, and therefore very simple solutions are attractive to him. But tariffs have, for example, as an economic tool, there's no recent example where tariffs have worked on a collective basis. And the type of kind of adversarial politics that he's engaging with Europe is very much unlikely to work. He does have temperamentally a bromance with Vladimir Putin. There's no question there. Anybody who looks at the way those bilateral summits went during his first presidency, where, you know, Putin would come very prepared with a long list of grievances and demands. And, Trump's own advisors, people like John Bolton, said that, for Trump, it seemed that the meeting was an end in itself. He was just so enamored with Putin. And he also has a similar mentality to Putin. I mean, the way he talks about getting Panama back, that they gave it away a century ago and it was a mistake and they want it back, is very similar to the way that Putin talks about Crimea, which, as you know, used to be part of the Russian part of the Soviet Union until it was given to Ukraine in 1956. Now, that was part of over 200 territorial changes during Soviet time, so it wasn't unique. But in exactly the same way. So they both have this kind of imperial mentality and Darwinian almost in geopolitics, that the stronger must dominate and can only be respected through throwing their weight around. So that's why I think that he, in many respects, has this kind of relationship with Putin. And similarly, his biggest friend in the European Union is Viktor Orbán. I mean, a man who similarly, has an illiberal view of the world and certainly also warms to other dictators.
Mm. I mean, suppose Putin decides that he'd love to get Alaska back.
Well, this is it. I mean, like, if you take Putin at his word, which is that any country which was formerly part of the Russian Empire and had Russian speakers, Alaska, it could be on the list. I mean, Alaska was handed back in the 1860s for $7 million. And indeed, there was a Russian colony in California at Fort Ross until 1841. So, you know, the Russian Empire has increased. I mean, you go back to the 15th century, Russia was the size of Albania today. Now it spans 11 time zones. You know, it goes from the Baltic Sea to the Pacific Ocean. It didn't do that without imperial expansion and conquering all the peoples that it met along the way and incorporating them into Russia. I mean, that's the big difference, of course, between the Russian Empire and the British Empire and the Spanish Empire, is that they had kind of, you know, colonial outposts that were many, many thousands of miles away, whereas Russia just incorporated new territories. And of course, every time you incorporate a new territory, you add to your insecurities, ironically, because you've new territories to defend and you meet new enemies across your borders. And that's one of the ironies, of course, as Putin invades Ukraine. I mean, it was supposed to make Russia more secure, but in many respects, of course, it has made Russia more insecure, because it was all, again, according to Putin, to stop NATO expansion. But since the invasion of Ukraine, NATO has expanded by two new members, Finland and Sweden, and the border of NATO and Russia has doubled since 2022. So again, he's not achieving his objective. So in that sense, he again shares something perhaps in common with Trump, that he has these, you know, simple notions, indeed old-fashioned notions, about how to make a country great again, territorial expansion, but it doesn't necessarily make you more secure.
Now, the question of why Trump is adopting this attitude, I mean, this infatuation with Putin, simply, I suppose, because of the enormous wealth that Putin has seized for himself and his apparent grasp on power, which is unchallenged. But is it also about minerals? Is it about the vast mineral wealth of Ukraine, estimated to be worth $12 trillion? And obviously, Putin has designs on these for industrial and military purposes, but Trump knows about them too.
Well, this seems to be something that Volodymyr Zelensky has dangled in front of Trump, you know, sensing his indifference to the fate of Ukraine, indeed hostility. He's tried to appeal to that kind of deal-making, transactional Trump by, you know, talking about these rare earth minerals that are in Ukraine. I'm somewhat doubtful about their value for a number of reasons. One, I mean, Ukraine has been independent for 30 years. It hasn't exploited them. If they're worth trillions, why hasn't Ukraine gone after them? One of the reasons is, and this is what many experts say, is that the cost of extracting those minerals would eclipse any profit that would be garnered from them. And then, of course, you know, in terms of the contemporary situation, many of those minerals are very close to the front line. Some are in areas already occupied by Russia. Some are, you know, are areas that Russia, of course, claims but doesn't quite occupy yet. So it's not quite clear how Trump would actually get his dividend. And Trump is actually looking for this, this access, this preferential treatment in terms of getting access to these minerals, in return for money he's already spent. He's not actually saying he's going to give money to Ukraine going forward. He's saying that Biden, of course, shouldn't have spent the money he did in supporting Ukraine. So he wants it as kind of a rebate. And I'm not sure that Ukrainians would have any interest in giving something for nothing in this respect. So I think it's all part of just keeping Trump's interest in Ukraine, because his interest, as we know, it's only 1 month of his presidency. It deflects from day to day. And, you know, U.S. military support has been very influential in keeping Ukraine well supplied. And therefore, they're trying to postpone what I think will be the inevitable disengagement of the U.S. But this talk of minerals is something that Zelensky himself has brought to Trump's attention.
What do you think of the MAGA project generally, the idea that you onshore everything, that you make America, which is incredibly wealthy and incredibly rich in natural resources? I mean, it does import stuff. It even imports oil and gas, which it doesn't actually need. It has its own reserves, which are massive. But the whole isolationism of the United States, I mean, is it doomed to failure?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's very similar in many respects to how America reacted to the Great Depression. I mean, America, as I said, its star is waning in relative terms. I mean, it seems fast to us because we're living through it in real time. But, you know, any great power that declines, it takes place over centuries usually. We're seeing it, I guess, over decades. And Trump is trying to arrest that decline with simple solutions like embarking on trade wars. But as I said, all historical precedent suggests that just hurts everybody and is a race to the bottom. In a way, it's the same kind of mentality. They are different cases, but similar. It's the same kind of mentality mentality that led to Brexit in Britain. This notion that, you know, you could regain Britain's greatness by isolation and having an adversarial relationship with its neighbours rather than cooperation and free trade, which is what the European Union is based on. Britain hasn't thrived post-Brexit, and the US, which is a much bigger economy, is unlikely to thrive in the absence of free trade and, as I said, making all these economic enemies. So the bottom line is that Trump's idea that, you know, the US is being taken advantage of is a rather puerile one, because the US is buying products from around the world. And it's not that it's giving money for nothing. It's buying products because they're well made and usually they're cheaper. They can't be made as cheaply or as well often in the United States. I saw his statement just in the last 24 hours about Taiwan, which, of course, is another area which we might be talking about in the near future if China decides to invade, which it may very well do when it sees how Ukraine is faring with its supporters. But it says that, you know, Taiwan has been cheating the United States by selling it high quality chips. But they've tried to manufacture these in the US and haven't succeeded over the years, which is why Taiwan has filled that gap. So I do think it's doomed to failure, this particular economic policy of Donald Trump.
Now, we look at the Constitution of the United States and we see there are supposed to be all these guardrails. You've got the different houses, the Senate and the House of Representatives. You have obviously the White House, the executive branch, and then you have the courts, all with Republican majorities at this time. But you're wondering, To what extent can all of this hold? I mean, is there no way that maybe the Supreme Court will actually look at the unfolding dictatorship or autocracy of Trump and say, well, we are the last bulwark. We've got to stop this.
I wouldn't be too optimistic.
Are no guardrails then?
There are some. I mean, the U.S. Constitution was designed to have guardrails, and that's even why elections are staggered in something like the Senate. They have them every 2 years, a third of them are elected. But the Supreme Court, 6 out of 9 are Republicans. Some of them have been nominated by Donald Trump himself. And you are seeing a politicization of the judiciary and indeed of government over the years. I mean, if you look at the American Constitution, it was built for the 18th century, a very different society. That's why everybody has a right to own a gun. You look at the German Constitution, it was written after World War II. The Germans are very unlikely to lose the run of themselves because it's built on the notion that if the Germans do lose the run of themselves, they'll become very authoritarian. So there's a lot of inbuilt checks which are almost draconian in terms of how they impede politicians. You don't have that in the United States. It's a very short constitution, only 7,000 words long, the shortest in the democratic world. And therefore, there's a lot of interpretation that can be given to any particular section in the Constitution. So the Supreme Court is vital. But because, as I said, of the politicization of the judiciary, I'm not sure that they will hold this particular executive in check. And therefore, we're in very dangerous waters because the global trend is towards authoritarianism. 70% of the world live in one form of authoritarian government or another. Liberal democracies like Ireland, about 12% of the population of the globe live in them. So we're a very rare bird. And as I said, we may become an endangered species.
And in the United States, there is that educational deficit. I mean, it's maybe one of the hopes of the sophisticated tech and pharma sectors here is that if they try to onshore them, the people may not be available in the United States. You know, Musk and his pals, they want to keep the HB1 visas going because simply there aren't educated people to take up those kind of jobs in the United States. So there are still maybe that's the problem for them, that their population has been almost deliberately undereducated.
That's true. And, there are many things that are deficient in the United States. You only have to visit to see it. I mean, one of Bernie Sanders' great points that he made when Trump was talking about annexing Greenland and taking it from Denmark, he said, rather than trying to steal Denmark's territory, could you not steal their ideas about free education and free healthcare? And they're the very things that Americans don't have. Their longevity even falls quite substantially behind many European countries. So they don't have the educated workforce necessarily. Immigration is a boon to America, not a curse. And the reason why they buy, as I said, so many products from other parts of the world is simply because they're the best quality and they're priced in the best way, which is also a benefit to the American consumer. And that's the whole basis of the free trade model, that people will try and come up with the best products and sell them at the best prices and everybody benefits. Trump is trying to rewrite that as he's trying to rewrite so many things. And as I said, I think he's not going to succeed, but he will create a lot of instability and unpredictability.
Donal Bahoin, a professor of politics at the School of Law and Government at DCU. Thank you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.